This is the Skin Science Podcast. I'm Dr. Thomas Hitchcock, and here we'll investigate everything skin science and dissect it from a scientific perspective, analyze it from a medical perspective, critique it from a consumer perspective, and give insight from an industry perspective.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Skin Science Podcast. I am Dr. Thomas Hitchcock, and with us in the studio, as always, we have Angela Wilson-McDonald. How are you doing, Angela?
I'm great. Nice to see you, Thomas. Why are you laughing?
Because I know it's a very emotional time for you.
Oh, here we go.
We're not supposed to say anything because the waterworks will come on.
Yes.
Anyway, it's a good thing. It's a bittersweet, positive thing. Yeah, and the birds are leaving the nest at our house. But anyway, we have a special guest today. We have David Weir. How are you doing, David?
So far, so good. It's Friday, so I'm seizing the opportunity. It's the end of the week.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It's funny, though, because I, after being an entrepreneur, you don't really get ends of weeks.
No.
And so I never see Fridays the same way now because it's like, I know I have to do something tomorrow anyway. So it's one of those things. But anyway, for those of you who may not know David, David is somebody that we know here because he lives in Dallas. He practices in the practice of Dr. Rod Rorick, correct?
Correct.
Yes. And so his a brief bio here is that he actually has been helping people look their best for over 22 years. As a nurse practitioner, David combines his experience in beauty, skincare education, and an artful eye for aesthetics, and an advanced practice education to educate clients on aging prevention and restoration, which is a mouthful to say that he educates people why things work and why they can use certain modalities to make them look good. And then David devotes up to 50% of his time doing safety, efficacy, non-inferiority, investigator-initiated trials, and new indication studies for the FDA, which is an important part of what we're going to talk about today when it comes to the topic at hand. So thank you, David, for being here.
Yeah, I appreciate the invite.
Yeah, and then we have in the peanut gallery, we have Dr. Jose Maldonado. How you doing, Jose?
I'm doing great.
Yeah, and we have Seti and Alan. How are you guys doing?
Great. How you doing?
Good. Thank you. Great. All right. So today our topic is going to be RF microneedling versus microneedling. And this is something that is, you know, we've been in the microneedling world for over a decade at this point. And so we've seen this come and ebb and flow and kind of the dynamics here. And I thought today would be an opportunity for us to kind of distinguish what's marketing, what's not. You know, what is this from a clinician's perspective versus a consumer versus an industry versus scientific, and kind of get some of the nuances so that people can understand. Just because we use a specific term doesn't mean it's the same thing necessarily. Mm-hmm. But before we do, science is a puzzle. And I'm a puzzle fanatic. And today I brought this puzzle here because I thought it would be fun for Angela to try to get this one. So this is a two-piece wooden puzzle, and the goal is to make it into a pyramid. So I'm going to leave that there.
Oh, okay. Great. Right. I'll work on that on the side of the discussion.
You know, she's gonna mock it now, but then as soon as she gets it, she'll be like all about it. We won't hear the end of it.
Yes, exactly.
But anyway, okay, so let's get into the idea of microneedling versus RF microneedling. All right, so how should we start? Should we start with a kind of consumer perspective, versus technical?
I'm going to reposition the title.
Okay, reposition it.
Because I have a little bit of beef with the title, because what we're talking about, one of the things we'll talk about is marketing that goes behind these products. And I'm quick to say that it's not RF microneedling, it's RF or radio frequency delivered by microneedles.
I call it fractional RF.
So, so that's a little bit when we talk about marketing, you know, microneedling has been a very hot item over the last decade. I'd like to think that we helped to create a little bit of that. And, you know, I think companies that come behind something that's very hot in the market, they're going to try to piggyback on it. And I think that happens both in the topical market as it comes to microneedling, and it happens with other devices as well. And I think this is a case for it.
Yeah, and you would expect that, right? If there's something hot in the market, people are going to want to try to, you know, follow suit. We've done similar things in the past at our company and such. And so I guess the real crux of it is understanding what the differences are,
yes.
right? So we can call it whatever we want.
Right.
But we have to understand, what does it do? What does it not do? What are the differences? And I think it's important because to some people, just the word needle alone just instills fear. And they just don't want to do it because just the fact that I have a friend that he doesn't care how good it can make him look or not look. He just, the fact that there's needles involved, he doesn't want to do it. But most people, once they've had it done, because they're numbed and everything, they realize it's not that big of a deal. So why don't we get into, so David, why don't you explain to us, because I know you actually train for devices, RF devices, RF microneedling or RF, fractional RF devices. Why don't you explain to us kind of what you say in your trainings to what it is, what the modality is, like what the mechanism of action is.
Okay, yeah. It's really funny because you said you have a friend that doesn't like needles. So I would use the old term. I would use the old term collagen induction therapy, and take the needle out of the equation because that's what it does. So when I'm explaining traditional microneedling, of course we're creating a mechanism of injury that tricks the skin, for lack of better words, to thinking it's more injured than it actually is. And when that happens, we activate the wound healing cascade. And part of that wound healing cascade is to actually increase collagen in the skin. Okay, collagen is one of those things that we start losing early on, and as we age, it causes the skin to thin. So a lot of buzzwords around marketing right now is like how to increase your collagen, even all the way up to like drinking it. Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll, I mean, it's a big buzzword.
Yeah.
So, but thinking about you know, collagen induction therapy, microneedling has been around for, I mean, you probably are an expert on that, but
the 50s,
a long time.
Yeah.
And then RF kind of made its debut about commercially 6 years ago, 5-6 years ago. And to your point, you know, RF microneedling is a bit of a misnomer. You know, when we are doing RF microneedling, we're not microneedling. We're just using those needles as a delivery mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, how do you differentiate the two? There's lots of data out there that kind of sways each way, but it also depends on who's kind of paying for the study, on which way that data might point.
You don't say.
Yeah, don't say. But in general, the main difference between RF microneedling and traditional microneedling is the addition of radio frequency. And the thought process by adding fractionated radio frequency to the skin is that you're going to create a thermal injury on top of a mechanical injury. And the rationale behind that is that if you create a deeper thermal energy, theoretically, I'm saying theoretically, you may have the ability to produce more collagen. Or most RF fractionated companies go for the claim of skin tightening.
Mm-hmm. Do they have that indication, or is that just something they...
Typically, it's like moderate to severe wrinkles.
Yeah.
As far as their indication. But to a degree, a skin tightening has to happen to help with moderate to severe wrinkles.
Well...
Or inflammation.
Because then
swelling.
We would say our skin tightens too, because we got wrinkle indications.
Yeah, you
but
do,
we don't.
Yeah.
We don't do really tighten, although there's going to be... That's part of the wound healing process is a tightening, right? But it's hard to get an FDA to allow you, say, tighten or lift or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult. I'm not even sure if the FDA has approved or cleared any devices for tightening. They might say it does that, but I don't think... Because I remember Althea back in the day, they were trying to get the tightening and they couldn't get it, so they got the lifting.
Lifting, yeah.
Because you can't really... It's hard to measure tightening
right.
of skin. It's easy to measure lifting because
yes.
you can measure architecture and such.
Yes.
So I guess that's a very good way, especially to a consumer, to explain it. But this is one of the problems that I'd like to bring up about this is even the name collagen induction therapy, I don't like. And the reason I don't like it is because one of the number one things we do with microneedling is to treat scars of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
And scars are mostly collagen.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're trying to get rid of the scar, why would we want to induce more collagen? And so I've been trying for years to get people to stop calling it collagen induction therapy and start calling it skin remodeling.
Mm-hmm.
Because the idea is you want to remodel the skin according to how your genetics say it should be normally. And that is where, in my opinion, and I want to hear you guys kind of talk about this fact, is my opinion is that that's where the difference between microneedling and what we call RF microneedling lie, because the two modalities, although needles are involved, one is concentrated on skin remodeling, where the other one's more concentrated on what, like you were calling, collagen induction. So it actually causes fibrosis on purpose because of that actually tightens more.
Correct.
So that's actually when all therapy, their whole thing was, and I used to get so irritated because they would make this like, these people would say these things like, you can treat like a 20-year-old because it's just putting collagen in the bank, you know, because of what you said that we are losing collagen as we age. I was like, no, that's not, there's no bank to put collagen into.
<I wish. laughs>
It's not like it stores it up there and then it comes out, you know.
I'll open an account right now.
So it's not the way it works. The way it works is you're creating an injury, and different types of injuries heal different ways. A very small injury is going to heal different than a big injury. If it's infected, it's going to heal different than if it's not infected. If it's a thermal injury or a chemical injury, it's going to heal different than a mechanical injury. And so the idea here is, I know that there's different ways of these devices. Some of them have insulated needles, some of them don't. And, you know, there's, you can equate these fractional RF devices to kind of having a little bit of similarity, not just to microneedling, but also to like fractional laser, you know? Because if you're putting that energy down through, now the big difference with all therapy, and I think the idea behind some of these modalities is that the needle goes in, and then you have the very tip where the coagulation happens, so it causes fibrosis without sparing the whole surface.
Correct.
And then you might get some remodeling because you're using needles, and it's poking needles, and it's going to heal that injury mechanically, right? So, but the thought is, though, I don't think people walk away with this idea in their head. They think collagen induction is great no matter how you do it, but it's different. It's the same as these fillers that have particulates. They cause fibrosis around the particulates, mm-hmm. which helps to keep that bulk there and stuff, but eventually it gets degraded or whatnot. But regardless, that I'd like to hear both of your opinion on, is this something that is as concerning to you guys as it is to me? Because frankly, consumers don't always have to know the nitty-gritty, mm-hmm. but are we telling them enough for them to make the decisions they need to make?
Ooh. And
and what does that sound like, David? So you're running your practice, and patient comes in, you're evaluating their skin, and you're trying to determine which modality is best for them. How are you going to describe RF to a patient? Let's kind of start there.
Because you can't give them a science lesson.
RF to a patient. Mm. Or let's talk patient types. When do you decide that RF is the best opportunity for that patient versus traditional microneedling done with a mechanical device?
Excellent question. It really boils down to what the patient is concerned about.
Right.
And me getting the diagnosis correct to treat them correctly. So if a patient comes in and let's say they have atrophic acne scars or superficial texture irregularities or what is bothering them, and let's say they're like anywhere between a Fitzpatrick 1 through 6, I will probably choose traditional microneedling. It's safer in all skin types. It's not using heat, so you run a much lower risk of causing anything like post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation other AEs that can be associated with heat or like laser energy or radio frequency energy. Now, if a patient comes in and let's say they're more mature, they're in their, I don't know what mature is anymore, but let's just say they have
laxity,
moderate to severe wrinkling, regardless of what age group they fall into, and they are on a safer Fitzpatrick to treat with RF, like maybe a Fitzpatrick 1, 2, and 3, so a Caucasian to maybe a light Hispanic person, then I might opt to discuss radio frequency with them. But sometimes I actually combine these modalities as well. So, you know, if they have superficial texture irregularities and I need the bang that a medical microneedling can provide for that superficial texture, but I also want to create more tightening, then I might combine some RF with it as well in those patients that it's safer to do so. RF, from the consumer perspective, make sure that you need to go to a qualified professional that knows what they're doing, because the AE profile for RF is significantly more exorbitant than the AE profile from medical microneedling as far as burns and pigment changes, and there's a lot more things that can go wrong
like
with RF.
What drives that? Like, what are some things that they they may need to look out for that they would do that causes those things?
Oh, yeah. So typically anybody who has a propensity for hyperpigmentation, anybody of a darker skin type or even some Asian, like Fitzpatrick 3 Asian skin types that have a propensity for hyperpigmentation, that would be someone that you would definitely be wary of with RF energy, because heat can cause changes in the melanocytes or the pigment producing cells in our skin. Other safety things to be considerate of would be, you know, what else is going on in their body? How do they heal normally? What is their wound healing process like? Do they have a history of keloids? There's a much longer list of treatment modalities that would make me avoid treatment with RF than there are with traditional medical microneedling.
Right. So how long does each, in your hands, how long does each treatment take?
Well, I think we should clarify. Yeah. Because RF, you do an area, correct?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And one thing that didn't come out in David's introduction is that he's actually treated me, and he's one of my favorite people in the industry. So we have a close relationship. But you've actually performed RF on me. And unlike traditional microneedling, where someone might come in and get their entire face and neck done and get consistent skin remodeling overall, you focused on a particular area on me when you did RF. And it was typically what bothers you most.
Right.
In that situation. Is that typical, David, that when you're deciding treatment to, you're only doing an area with RF versus...
Typically, yes. Because it's where I see more moderate laxity, more moderate wrinkling in the skin, that I'm going to think RF might be a better option for that area. But let's say the upper face, where people don't typically experience a lot of skin laxity. You know, if I was to RF their upper face, it would be more... exciting of a treatment, because RF is RF.
That's a very kind way to put it.
RF is spicy compared to traditional microneedling. And when I compare the difference in just overall superficial textural improvement, it's much faster, safer, and easier to do traditional microneedling. Okay. So that might be one of those areas where I combine them. And, you know, the upper face, I might do traditional microneedling. And then in the lower face where the jowl is forming or they're getting some radial cheek lines, I might do some RF.
Is this the same time or is this different times?
I would do it at the same time. Yeah.
So that's what I was getting at, is how long does it take?
Okay.
And if you're trying to do that.
So treatment time, I mean, a traditional medical microneedling from start to finish, maybe an hour. And that's going to include the patient coming in, your consents, your topical anesthetic, your pre-photos, you know, 20 to 30 minutes of actual traditional microneedling treatment. Okay. Most of my RF patients are booked for at least 90 minutes because it's a combination of topical, and then I typically do a tumescent solution or local injections of lidocaine.
Did that? Did you do that for you?
No, I don't recall getting that.
I would rather have the tumescent.
It depends on the patient's pain tolerance. I do the topical first, and then we do a couple test pulses, and if they're okay, then you just continue with the treatment. But there's a good, you know, 60, 70% of the population that's like, ooh,
that's a little more than expected.
A little spicier than I thought. So we'll do mix up some wetting fluid or tumescent solution, do some injections in the face, and then the area goes completely numb, and then it's completely tolerable. But that takes a little bit more time.
Sure. So that's interesting. So if you wanted to throw, let's say, into that 90 minutes, would you be able to throw microneedling and have be about the same time, or would it take more time? I mean, I'm assuming it takes more time, but
I mean,
you don't have to do all the other stuff again, right? You don't have to do the
So if I want to throw medical microneedling into it, absolutely, I could do it in the same treatment. And when it changed the variability of time much, you know, with RF microneedling, a lot of it is being able to cover the entire surface area and how long that takes with the patient's tolerance. Whereas traditional medical microneedling, I'm looking at how many passes I'm doing and how long the needle's actually on the skin.
Right.
Because a lot of these needling devices, you know, they have studies out there that show, you know, how fast the needles move, how many puncture sites it's making. So part of the true microneedling is how long is the needle actually touching the skin? How many of these tiny little micro channels are you creating?
Yeah.
Whereas RF is more like, you know, how long does it take to cover the entire treatment area?
Right.
So it's a little bit more dependent, RF is, on the patient tolerance and how well they can take it.
Right. So you touched on a point that's important to distinguish them, that if you have a million holes that are created through mechanical microneedling or traditional microneedling, then it's a million little islands that can be remodeled. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of part of the modality, is you want to get as much of those as possible. You don't need to necessarily make them bleed or anything. Mm-hmm. You just want to get as many as possible, because it's like if I take a needle and poke myself, my whole skin doesn't remodel on my body.
Right.
So you have to, you know, get as many islands to remodel. With the RF, it's you wouldn't be able to do that. You'd completely coagulate your whole skin, and that would be horrible. So it's about making sure that you separate those far enough to not have issues, but keep them close enough that you get the fibrosis that will tighten and yes. lift and such.
Especially with RF, because with RF, you have to make sure, like you said, it is fractionated coagulation.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do too many passes, or you're too aggressive, or your energy is too high, then you are no longer fractionated.
That's true. Yeah.
And you're doing a complete undermining of the skin for coagulation, which can backfire on you.
Yeah.
So,
have you seen that happen?
I have, especially with fat atrophy with RF. Mm. Either, which is the worst thing you could possibly do to somebody who has fine lines and wrinkles and jowls, is to make them worse.
Mm.
Okay. So again, going to somebody who knows what they're doing, you have to make sure that the zone of coagulation is set low enough that you're not completely coagulating the underlying dermis and the superficial fat. Because if you overcoagulate it, use too much energy, you can cause some fat loss.
Yeah. So do they teach... I don't know. I've never been in nursing school. Do they mm-hmm. teach these types of devices in nursing school, or is it something that you get into a practice and you got to learn?
You've got to learn.
So who teaches you then?
Typically, it's the manufacturer okay. of the device. And then hopefully through nursing school or medical school or NP school or PA school, you've learned some good sound clinical reasoning.
Right.
And you have to, you know, source the information for yourself sure. or look for it in the published data.
Yeah. And do you find that a lot of the, because you probably worked with, at least been sold to mm-hmm. by a very large amount at this point of companies that have either come and gone.
Every day. That's why I keep my door locked. So no one can just show up unannounced.
So do you find, like, what percentage of those companies, especially with, let's say, devices considered like energy-based, or let's just say all devices, mm-hmm. how many percentage of those do you feel train adequately so that people can actually get the best results with less safety issues?
Let's just say they're, percentage-wise.
Because I'm not going to call any company out. I just want to kind of know in the industry, are we doing a good job? Or yeah. Are we not doing
a
good job?
Are they learning everything they need to know yeah. when they adopt these devices?
In my mind, I want to say 1 out of 5 companies.
Oof, yeah. That's low.
And but I would actually say it's yeah. actually lower than that, maybe yeah. 1 out of 10.
Okay.
That truly go through every single step through the process, and not just the process itself, because it's very easy to teach the procedure.
Mm-hmm.
It's much harder to teach why you're doing the procedure, the reason,
the choices you're making in that yeah. moment, and why.
And why, and yes. how to, you know, engage and change your settings on the fly. And,
sure.
You know, a lot of that comes with experience, obviously, yeah. of using the device. You know, a lot of devices, and I tell this to my patients, is, you know, a third of your result is me, okay, in my education and my experience. A third of the result is the device I choose, okay? And then about a third of the result is you.
What you do when you leave.
How well you yeah. leave, like, or how well you heal, yeah. what you do with your post-care, et yeah. cetera. So that kind of puts things a little bit more in perspective. And, you know, there's been times with traditional microneedling or even RF microneedling that I have treated patients and I didn't get the result that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay, was it me? Was it the device? Or was it the patient? I always blame the patient. But, but in general, you know, sometimes we have to pivot, and especially in all things in medicine, you know, if you have someone come in, they have an infection, and you give them an antibiotic, and that antibiotic doesn't work, you have to pivot and try a different antibiotic.
Right.
And that's how I approach a lot of devices and treatments and whatnot in my practice.
Yeah. I mean, that's all sounds good. And I think I'm a little bit let down that our industry is failing the people that are providing these treatments. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I think all of us know of people that have gone to a provider and not been happy with something mm-hmm. that happened. And a lot of times I feel like it's not necessarily because there's anything nefarious happening. It's because there was probably not proper training, especially for somebody who's new. And there's a large turnover of technicians and medical assistants and stuff that are delegated to. And sometimes we assume they know more than they do. Yeah. And sometimes they're too afraid to speak up that they don't know something because they don't want to look stupid. You know, anybody who's a teacher or has ever taught knows that it's sometimes hard to get people to admit what they don't know because they're afraid to look stupid when you want them to do that. Cause you want to, you're like, I want to make sure you're okay. I want and educate you.
And to add to your point, I think there might be a large group of people that don't want to speak up cause they don't want to appear like they don't know.
Right.
But I also know there's even a larger group as someone who trains all over the country of professionals that don't know that they don't know.
That is the bigger problem, I guess.
That's the bigger problem.
You know? They don't know what questions to ask.
Yeah.
They don't know that just because a company gives you a protocol on a device like what we're talking about, that
that's not good enough.
Yeah.
You've got to understand the why of the choices you're making along the way. And I think, you know, that's one of the reasons I've always respected the work that you've done, David, and why I let you actually, you know, perform that on me, because I wanted to understand that experience as well. And you've shared something over the years, too, that there's a certain number of a percentage of non-responders. And what I've learned from Thomas over the years, when you're talking about the patient, it's not necessarily what they do when they leave there. It could just be their genetics. It could be their age. It could be their general health. All that is playing into the response they get.
Absolutely.
So what percentage, and what, well, I'll ask you this question, then I've got a follow-up question. What percentage of patients that you perform RF on would you suggest are non-responders? And what do you mean by not, what are you looking for to determine if they are a responder or not a responder?
That's a fantastic question, Angela. And I think everyone responds to a degree.
Okay.
But does that response meet their expectation?
That's a tougher.
It's a tougher equation. You know, if someone comes in and they're interested in skin tightening and they go, you know, I want something like this.
You want a facelift.
I say you want a facelift then. Yeah. You don't want RF. Like, you don't want anything I can do, literally. Because if you're wanting to do this, that's surgery. There's nothing out there that can do that for you. So I think setting up realistic expectations for patients and not being the yes guy. I mean, I turn more people away from procedures than the procedures I actually do because people come in and they want something that's just not achievable with non-invasive aesthetics.
Right.
So I think the non-responders might be much higher in other practices because they're just trying to treat everyone. And maybe they don't have a good relationship with a team of plastic surgeons like I do, where they're just trying to, you know, they only do injectables. They only do RF. They only do microneedling. So they're trying to fix all the world's problems with those devices because anything else might not be in their scope.
Right.
Whereas I would much rather, you know, have someone, if they come in and they do this, say, okay, well, you need to go have a consultation for a facelift because I'm not going to waste your time. I'm not going to waste your money because then you're going to be upset with me because I told you I could do something that just physically isn't possible.
Right.
So I think everyone does respond, but sometimes the response isn't good enough or noticeable enough or impactful enough to where they can see it. So therefore, it wasn't worth their time.
Or you weigh, right? You're weighing of what did that procedure cost me? Mm-hmm. What did it feel like?
Yeah.
What was my downtime, if any? And then, like, did the result that I got, was it consistent with what I had to experience or what I had to pay for that, right? And that's kind of what you're judging in that process as well. The other thing, the follow-up to that is, RF is typically sold, as is traditional microneedling, in packages. So patients, and you're smiling, I know you know where I'm heading with this. And patients, you know, in traditional microneedling, we say, you know, this is a non-invasive procedure. And there is evidence in the scientific literature that if we come at it several times as we're remodeling the skin and give it the proper time to remodel, which studies show is around 6 months after injury or micro injuries in this case, you know, that's when we really see the full result of that package of procedures. And so here we go with that marketing of RF microneedling. The same protocol is being followed of selling it in packages. But you have an interesting perspective on that.
So I don't sell packages.
Yes.
You planted that question. and I'm not a fan of packages. And the reason why is because if I could predict how many treatments you need or I predict the future in general, I would have probably won the Powerball a couple days ago, and I wouldn't be sitting here.
And I wouldn't either, right?
You would be
friends.
On a yacht in Spain somewhere with me, okay? But in general, I can't predict the future when it comes to these treatments, so I don't sell packages. Now, I do tell patients, you know, whatever device I'm using, based on the clinical trial, they had one session every 30 days for three treatments. They did post follow-up photos at this day, this day, this day. And that's how it's set up. So a lot of patients or a lot of people who read the instruction manual say everyone has to have three treatments. But I know that some patients, you know, a third of the response is how the patient responds. So I know some patients might not respond. So why make them buy three sessions or five sessions or whatever up front if I don't know how they're going to respond? So I err on the side of being a lot more cautious, especially with people's money. Mm-hmm. And I say, okay, we'll do one. We'll wait, you know, 6 to 8 weeks. We'll do some photos and we'll compare. And if we see a change, a significant enough change that we think
it was worth the money, the time, yeah,
et cetera, then we'll do another one. We'll work them in synergy. But I know that eventually you will plateau. Eventually you will come in. We'll do a treatment. We'll have pre-treatment photos. I'll bring you back in a couple months. We'll do photos again. And there's no difference. There's only so much, specifically with RF, that you can tighten the skin before the skin just says,
that's it.
That's it. That's all you get. And I can't tell if that's two treatments for you, five treatments for you. They're all very young, but maybe just two treatments. I don't know. You know, I don't know is the actual answer.
Right.
And I mean, I'm not trying to diss anybody out there that's selling packages, but I don't know how they can determine how many sessions someone's going
to
do.
Well, I think it goes back to marketing. Again, if you're advertising a product that is traditional microneedling on steroids, which is actually some of the marketing that's used, then you're going to follow some of those similar protocols. But what you're suggesting is two very different processes are occurring in the skin. Oh. And based on that, and considering what the patient is paying, what they're experiencing, am I able to get the full area or just a smaller area of the face? All those things, there's so much that has to be considered. It really isn't just, you know, again, take whatever the company gives you and run with it. There's a lot that needs to go into making decisions for patients.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, with both treatments, I do tell them typically it's not a one and done. You know, typically, I mean, unless you just have one tiny little wrinkle or one tiny little atrophic acne scar, you know, typically it's a series, but I don't know how many that will be. I mean, I have some patients that I've done six RF sessions on. I have some patients that I've done six microneedling sessions on, and they still keep responding. So we still continue to treat them.
Right.
But eventually you will plateau. So, but I can't really predict that when that will be with any given patient.
And that's one of the things, we're not letting Thomas talk today.
I'm actually enjoying not talking. But
that's one of the things you've taught us over the years, Thomas, is the body naturally wants to acclimate. Mm-hmm. It's just like exercising. You know, we're not, it's not suggested that we do the same exercise daily. We're supposed to mix it up and trick the body into doing things differently. Same with the skin, right? The skin wants to naturally acclimate. So what David is saying and what we've learned over the years is, it's fine to do a package in particular of traditional microneedling, but then you got to give the skin time to regenerate and remodel, evaluate the result, and decide where to go further. But that continuous sometimes can work against you in terms of acclimation. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so the thing is, you don't want to ever put your body in a state of stress chronically. And that's what we do when we, and I frankly think that's similar to how my philosophy for topicals, and I know that's controversial, but like, I don't believe everybody should be using moisturizers every day, because then our body basically is now stressed because it's doing something unnatural in the way it's shutting things off or turning things on. But that's a complete deviation from the subject. But the fact is, it's correct that the body reacts to stresses by upregulating certain genes and downregulating certain genes, producing substances, not producing substances. And we're going to, in our next podcast, talk about exosomes and your feelings on those. And that's part of my beef with that, is that the body produces a lot of these signals and such as a response to stressors. And the fact is, while an acute dose of these stress signals can cause a beneficial aesthetic change, we often in our industry don't know what that is happening, and we have this like more is better mentality, which is a horrible in medicine. Dosage is everything, mm-hmm. you know? And so the same with treatments, dosage of treatment mm-hmm. is important. And I think you're smart to try it once, see how they react. The fact is, if they're expecting an immediate result with something that takes 6 months to happen to the finish line, and also a lot of people, what happens is they'll see nothing in a month and think I wasted my money, and then not realize that 5 months later, if they had taken their before and afters then, mm-hmm. they probably would see something a little different.
Well, and I learned that trick doing clinical trials, and it was my outlying patients that couldn't finish the study. You know, they couldn't follow the treatment protocol.
Yep.
That, you know, they had one treatment, but then they got pregnant or mm-hmm. They got diagnosed with something that disqualified them, or they moved or whatever. That we would do one treatment, and I would see them 6 months later just because they were coming to my clinic for something else. And we'd do photos, and I'm like, wow.
What'd you do to your skin? Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, wow, that, you know, when I saw you 5 months ago, it didn't look this good. Mm. You know, but 6 months after treatment, it looks great. And I mean, that's with a lot of the things I do. So sometimes to both of your points, just letting the body heal may produce the result on its own.
Right.
So sometimes overstressing them, even, you know.
Sometimes one treatment might be okay.
Yeah, sometimes it might be okay. So that's why I tend to space everything out a little bit further than most people, just because I want to see what the skin's capable of doing on its own.
It's smart because people are impatient.
Yeah.
We and, are. Just mm-hmm. That's our nature.
And I think it's worth saying, too, that you have the luxury. You mentioned mm-hmm. you're in, you know, a very well-known plastic surgery practice, mm-hmm. and you have the luxury of having a photo photographer mm-hmm. on staff and a photography room. So mm-hmm. the level of your photography allows you to practice on a different level. What would you suggest, David? What if you didn't have that? Because many practices don't have a means mm-hmm. of taking good photography. They might rely on iPhones. They might, mm-hmm. you know, some of them might have well-known, you know, devices in the industry that do a little better job in standardizing that. But what do you suggest?
With photography in general?
Yeah, well, being able to operate at the level at which you operate, but yet not have that photography available to you.
I mean, photography is almost one of the most important parts about not having people pissed at you.
Yeah.
You would say find a photography source?
I would find a photography. Yeah. But even there are smaller equipment setups out there that you can use. The biggest thing with before and after photography is that you want to make sure it's a very neutral background. If you plan on publishing, it probably needs to be a blue background.
Most people don't. Yeah. Most people aren't going to do that.
It needs to have consistent lighting. So if you don't have a photo studio with photographers, you know, have a closet. I know that sounds funny, but have a closet in your practice.
Windows are your
enemy.
That has
the same light source. Yeah. And then use the same camera for it always. If you're using an iPhone or an iPad or, you know, any sort of mobile device, you know, go to Amazon and buy like a little tripod that you can set it on, so you can at least try to get the height and angles correct. And there are different photo apps out there.
But you would say that's key.
That's important. So lighting is key. Consistency is key. And it, to your point, like if you have a room that has windows, like that is the most terrible time, mm-hmm. terrible place to take photos.
Because the sun moves.
So if you take their before photos at, you know, 11 a.m. and then take their after photos at 8 p.m., your lighting is going to be completely different. Mm-hmm. And that will completely alter your outcome. The way it looks, the look of the outcome.
Mm-hmm. Which this is super important. So we do have to end because we're out of time. But, you know, I think that was a great conversation kind of from soup to nuts about, you know, the differences and how to best implement into practices. My kind of takeaway from all this is to let people know that the differences are not trivial. And the differences of how they're going to work and how soon it will be before you see differences in this quality of skin, whether it's tightness or retexturing, can be different based on the modality. They should not be used the same. I actually just reviewed a paper that I said should be rejected, and I think it was. They were trying to make the argument that they're the same thing, and I was like, no, it's absolutely not true. Yeah. And so, you know, that's something that in our industry, I challenge the aesthetics industry, plastic surgeons, dermatologists, and all of the healthcare providers that work in those offices to put more pressure onto the industry to provide better training. Because I think that's part of the battle is you know, we understand the rationale for calling it RF microneedling, but don't rest on that. Rest on the fact that your device can do something good. And if you train properly, you're going to get really good results rather than trying to like steal thunder from another complementary modality. And that's what I've always tried to instill in our sales force is I have no say with him, but I've recommended that, you know, don't try, you know, trashing something else. Just say what's good with yours and how it can complement and such. And then that way we kind of all win. But sometimes
and the patient wins.
Yeah, the
most
patient
importantly.
Wins. Well, we all is part of patients. But it's part of, you know, us all learning and trying to help each other raise the tide so that all ships can raise. Because we all want it to be successful. Nobody wants to hurt anybody. Nobody wants to steal any money from anybody. But, well, maybe some people. I don't know. But anyway, thank you, David, for being here and talking about this with us. We've been waiting for a while for this because, you know, when she had her treatment, she was like all a flutter about your skills there. So
that's true. That is true.
Anyway, I see you have not solved the puzzle, so we're going to go ahead and end the podcast.
No, I'll do that at a later date.
All right, so David, if they wanted to follow you on social media, where would they find you?
Oh, it's my handle's Ultimate Skin Source, and that's all one word, Ultimate Skin Source.
And is that just Instagram?
Instagram, Facebook, those are the only two modalities I have. I don't have a website or anything crazy like that.
But does Dr. Rourke have one as well? Don't you have like a podcast where he does it?
Yeah, so he does Rourke Knows.
Yeah,
so we do a few podcasts. I don't do all the plastic surgery ones. I do the non-invasive stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's Rourke Knows on YouTube. And it's Knows, K-N-O-S-E. Little fun take on words there. But yeah, and you can follow him at rod.org on Instagram as well.
All right. And Angela, where can they find you?
Well, here we go. I am excited to say, and what Thomas was alluding to at the beginning of the podcast is my twins leave for college this week. And so
everybody get the tissues.
I'm okay at this moment. At this moment. Not going to promise in the next moment. But I am going to become an Instagram sensation.
She said that a year ago.
I am at Angela Wilson McDonald on Instagram. And don't be overwhelmed by my three posts. But do keep an eye out because they're coming.
You might have to rebrand before you blow up.
Time. I know. I should, shouldn't I?
Yeah. Should rebrand.
Angela Knows.
That'd be hilarious.
Angela N-O-S. Yeah, Knows. Apostrophe S. Anyway, okay. So thank you, everybody. Thanks to all of our Peanut Gallery producers. And we hope that you gleaned something from this conversation. And until next time, we'll see you later. Goodbye for now.